We are going to wrap up a review of the book of Exodus today, and then I'm going to ask you some questions. Last week we went over Exodus chapter 1 all the way to the 6th chapter, and the primary thing that, we, if you remember last week, a few minor things, we won't go through that today, but to be able to go back, when I'm finished with this thing, you can probably go back and review and have any questions or I'm not questioned, but what have you learned from the book of Exodus, from, you know, chapter 1 all the way to the 40th chapter in this short period of time? Of course, we didn't have a short period of time. It's a very long, laborious time. So basically, from chapter 7 to chapter 11, I'm not going to discuss today, not because it's not important, but it is basically the destruction of Egypt. Okay, from chapter 7 to chapter 11, it's the total destruction of Egypt, all the way to the killing of the firstborn. And in Exodus, the 12th chapter, is a very interesting statement, which I want to kind of backtrack here a little bit. He says, here go, the Eternal saying, speaking unto the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of this month, you shall take to them every man a lamb according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. And you shall keep it until the 14th day of the month, and the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it at evening or between the evenings. It's very fascinating here to stop and think about just this statement. Now, when I look at this thing, and this is my personal opinion, I'll try to back it up at the end of the chapter, end of the book, rather, that he would have spoken this unto Moses on the first day of the first month. I'll try to back that up as we reach into the conclusion of today. Now, we already know that they had to have the fire for the Passover, had to get it started. And we also know that they would have had to have burned up all of the meat, or of the leftovers, I should say, during that night before the morning. Now, not talk about daylight morning, but it's called the third watch. And then go into the morning watch. So they left pretty close around midnight. So they left and burnt up all the things before they even were to leave. Okay? Before the angel came and wiped away all the house of Israel. I mean, all the house of Israel, the firstborn. Israel, I'm sorry, Egypt, firstborn. And, of course, what protected them, of course, we know, is the blood upon the two doorposts and on the overhead as well. And they roasted it and had their food. Chapter 13 goes into, and it says, now, this is a very fascinating thing I want to kind of backtrack and explain here a little bit. It says, every first blood of the ass you shall redeem and of with a lamb. And if you do not redeem it, then you shall break its neck. And all the firstborn of man among children shall be, you shall redeem. And it shall be that when the son asks you, why do we do these things? And he says, because God brought us out with a strong hand, a strong power. Now, I said, now, this is the reason, verse 15, it says, this is the reason why I redeem my firstborn son. So what does that tell you a little bit? That's a question I want you to ask yourself. What does it mean by this? Because they just got seeing something that took place. The lamb was the one that was redeemed for the sons of Israel. It was not redeemed for the house of Egypt. And therefore, they were killed. The real simplicity of the matter, simplicity, not really simplicity, is the clarification of why you are to tell your children why we do this thing is because the Lamb was redeemed for us. And since the Lamb was redeemed for us, we don't have to have our firstborn son or our heritage, future heritage, being killed and wiped out. Now, as we go through the time, they traveled through the, going to the sea, and the sea was opened up, and Moses, they turned to God, what are we going to do, you know? Well, he says, take out your stick. Stick. Take out the rod, all right? And part the water. And the water opened up, and down they came. Yes?
Two quick questions. One, it doesn't say that to have your firstborn spared, it doesn't say that you have to be an Israelite. So an Egyptian who was sympathetic could have painted
God
upon his
God began with them first. Okay, we'll get down there in the future. But this is telling us how he begins, how he operates. This is what I'm saying. And now we have the chance to have the lamb slain for our children.
Okay, because an Egyptian
when we raise our sons up and our daughters up, we need to let them know that the lamb is the one that redeemed us. All right? But I'm not there. But you understand what I'm saying.
And then real fuzzy in my thinking, the question is, it seemed to me the Hebrew here says that the lamb was a singular lamb that all the house of Israel was to place its hand on.
Right.
Kill the lamb.
Correct. Singular.
Not individual lamb. Although they had individual lambs.
So it becomes very personal.
Okay.
All right. Thanks. It's not true. It's not a plurality of lambs. It's just a lamb redeemed for the firstborn. You know, so it involves everybody. All right. I'm not arguing with you. I agree with you. Saying, yeah. I don't have a problem. In the 15th chapter, there are a couple of things I want to mention here. You remember what God led them to a place where there was bitter waters. Okay, what was his object? What did he say? After they couldn't take the water anymore because it made them sick, he turned around, I led you there to this place of bitter waters so you will know that I am the one that's going to heal you. And the very next scene now, they blessed him with the lamb with an awful lot of palm trees and a lot of water. There were 70 palms and 12 wells of water. And these are the abundance of the blessing that God said, now I healed you. Now this is my blessing to you, and I'm giving and providing for you. And the palms represent righteousness. His righteousness, not the people's righteousness. And the water is living water. Any water comes out from a well, it's always flowing. And it's living water. It kind of puts you in the realm of where Yeshua said, from your bellies or from your innermost part, water of life will flow from you. And so you have a picture here of the earth, of course, in this case, because it's just a picture, bringing forth living water so they could be healed. Of course, it took a tree to do that, which, of course, took representation of a certain tree, not the tree that was listed, but it took the death of the Messiah hanging on a tree for that to take place. And so it was cast into the water and brought forth life. The water became, which was once polluted therein, in the previous one, was now healed. And they could drink the water that would heal them. Those are just parallels to understand a little about where the Messiah is shown in this part. And in the 16th chapter, remember he had to do about proving them with manna. And he had to find out if they would do something. And so he withheld something from them, and then forth they, of course, complained. And we always remember what they did. They complained. But why did God withhold it before they complained? Well, because he said to you, I'm going to find out, I'm going to test you out, I'm going to find out what you're made up of. And he says, that I may, verse 4 of chapter 16, I'm going real fast, that I may prove whether they will walk in my laws and in my way. It's a test proof to find out if they have this stamina to do it, even though God brought forth that hardship. We went through the 50 days, right? Long, long time, right? And we saw the difficulties they really were in, and that God put them in those difficulties every single way. Every single 50 days, he put them in that realm of difficulty. And, of course, he led them, of course, to the Mount Sinai and the Rock of Hovrov and got water from them. They complained about water. They couldn't dive again. And so Moses had to strike the rock, and out came water. And the people were able to have water and feed their flock and to clothe themselves, get themselves clean. And then, of course, another thing that took place after they got the water and then the rock was split open, something else happened. God sent them a war. He sent the enemy out against them. And as you know, Moses had to lift up the rod, and he and his two friends had to hold up his hands or his arms during the entire process, meaning that the rod will not remain high without the help of these two men. And that's what's quite fascinating of it by itself. We won't go into that today. All right, now we went through that before. That his hands were heavy. And, of course, he couldn't lift it up. In chapter 9, we're moving very quickly here. Now to chapter 19. And he says now, it had to do with Moses going up to Elohim, and Yahuwah called unto him the mountain, saying, thus shalt thou say unto the house of Jacob, and tell the children of Israel. And this is prior to the Ten Commandments being given. And he said, now go and tell them, if they will obey, or hear, should be hark, shema, my voice indeed, and keep my covenant, then ye shall be a peculiar people unto me above all people of the earth, and ye shall be unto me kingdom of priests. Now, it's very fascinating to stop and think about this, because the Torah talks about kingdoms of priests, not kings and priests. In the latter book of the Revelations, we have the rulings, right? And they are ruling with the Messiah, and they are priests who are ruling with the Messiah. So it's not a kings and priests, it's kings of priests, or priests who have kingship. So you're running, basically, in a sense, two offices, if I could use that word, two things. What can't do one without the other, basically. And this is a promise that's not yet been fulfilled, is it? It's not yet happened. But it will happen when the Messiah comes and he will reign. That has not yet happened, but it will happen. And there will be a kings of priests. Now, a priest has a very special function. Of course, the Messiah is one of the pictures of a priest, but a different kind of a picture than perhaps we have a picture of our modern-day 20th century priesthood, or maybe even our thinking of what the priesthood was during during the time of, well, not Moses, but during the time of the kings, maybe, or during the time of the Messiah. And, the high priest became an arrogant thing rather than a king of a priesthood. The function of a priesthood was to do something. And the book of Hebrews explains that. We won't go there. But most of you know the background of that, so we don't have to go back to that point. So, and he says, of course, now the cloud came and unable to do it, and he had the 3 days, and the Ten Commandments were given. Verse chapter 20, we won't go through that chapter. Not needed to go through the chapter, but the people were terrified, weren't they? And they said, don't, Moses, don't, we don't want to hear him anymore. Why? He scares us to death, literally. You know, terrified, so frightening. The voice was so powerful, the sound was so powerful. I know some of you may have, maybe when you're growing up, not so much as adults, because we're adults, we're past that point, right? Anyway, so terrified that fear comes so quick and so hard and so fast, your heart's pounding like crazy, and you're scared to death, and your mind can't even think. All of a sudden, they're just hearing, and you don't pay attention to, yeah, I agree, I disagree. What's that mean? What's he talking about? No, you just kept silent because you're so terrified. And that's how God does it. And he says, I did this for one reason. And Moses says, it did that they may fear Elohim. They may fear God from that point on. So God brought forth fear to them so they would understand his very important place. One thing I want to backtrack a little bit. Remember, Moses was complaining to God that he had not delivered Israel. That was before the Exodus. And God turned to him and says, you wait until I see what I'm going to do to Pharaoh. And my name was known as El Shaddai. Have you forgotten, Moses, who I am? How powerful I am? How mighty I am? I destroyed the entire world in 40 days. Pew, gone. That's a pretty powerful person, isn't it? So you have to. And he had to put fear, in a sense, into Moses. So Moses also had to quake and tremble, like you would quake and tremble, at the presence of this voice, the presence of the power of God. And the world is coming to a point pretty soon, whether they like it or not, where it says there in Revelation, we'll go there, that the heavens and the earth try to run away from God. And they couldn't. No place for them to hide. You can't, you're so terrified, you don't want to face him, but guess what? You got to face him anyway. And therefore judgment came. Both to heaven and earth. There, and it says, now, verse chapter 21, the very interesting statement. I'm going to just chapter 21 all the way to, let me get to that, all the way to chapter 39 is dealing with, no, to 24 rather, to 21 to 24 is dealing primarily what's called judgments, not statutes, judgments. Remember he said judgments and statutes of judgments. And I want to go comment on one of them, okay? And that's the very first judgment. You remember the very first judgment he said? Very fascinating. Both my son and John talked about it at the feast. Bond servant. A first judgment was from that point of view. First thing he talked about. We may not understand it, quote, on the surface, but go into the spiritual realm, it's fully understood. And you become a bond servant of the Messiah, become a bond servant of the Creator of heaven and earth, and then you will do, and you will want to do, whatever he wants, to the point where you will give up your life to serve the Master. You'll give up your life to serve the Master. That's like taking up your cross. You're going to serve the Master. Why? Because you love the Master. And remember, the Master gave him a wife and gave him the children. If the guy left, he doesn't get the wife, doesn't get the children, because they don't belong to him. They belong to the Master, meaning the Creator of heaven and earth, the sustainer of life. They're his first. He owns them. And you're not about to give them up just because one may not wish to be with. But if he turns and says, I want to be there. So it's just a note on that one. It's a very interesting judgment, though, isn't it? Very interesting judgment. Chapter 24, we'll jump to 24. The judgments continue on through chapter 23 and 24. But it says here that at the 20 elders of Israel worshipped afar off. They're supposed to come up to Moses. But not all of them went up as far as Moses went. Okay, so they came back and they had, and he said, I want you to go down and I want you to teach these judgments to the elders that came up with you to this point. And so Moses came back and told them. And something about very interesting in verse 7 of 24, it says, the book of the covenant. He took the book of the covenant and read in the presence of those 70 elders. And they said, all that Yahuwah has said, we will do. We will be obedient. And then, of course, Moses built an altar. And there was two offerings given up that time. And one was a whole offering, or the burnt offering. And then one was a thanksgiving offering. When they're giving praises and thanks to God. And then he took the blood from those two animals. And he sprinkled the Book of Covenant with it. Made it binding, made it that they agreed with the entire scene. So it's very interesting to know how that picture comes. Now, chapter 24 to 34 talks about the tabernacle and the priestly garments and how they're made in preciseness and in detail, more than before. And so it's kind of a beautiful way of looking at it, knowing that everything had to be put in exact place, exact order, exact position, and place in exact time. And then he said something here, chapter 40. On the first day, verse 2, chapter 40, on the first day of the first month, ye shall set up the tabernacle of the tent of meeting. Interesting. First day of the month, you shall set up the tabernacle. All right? Very fascinating thing. One of the things that we find in this book of Exodus is what? You need to answer that question. The time from the first year when Elohim began to bring out Israel to bring them to the second year is about Elohim. That was 1 year. Did you recognize? It was 1 year. From the time God said, on the first day of this month, you will take a lamb and you will do this. 1 year later, the tabernacle was erected. That's pretty fast, don't you think? It's not like it took 20, 30, 40 years like we're just saying. Maybe to build something, we have to have all sorts of permits and we have to have the blessings of this and that and all sorts of stuff. Okay, and the people gave their money willingly. All right, now that being said, I want to ask you some questions now. What is it you have learned about the book of Exodus that you may not have learned before? What was your viewpoint and compared now to the viewpoint?
I don't think I had any viewpoints changed, but I thought I was aware of all the foreshadowing. There's much more foreshadowing pointing to Messiah than
what
I'd
more,
seen before.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
Because he said, it's there, it talks about me. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, okay. You know, Daniel's going through the kings. It's talking about me, he says. And so we start recognizing, seeing these things. So God letting us see his plan from the very beginning. What else have you learned? Anybody? Don't be afraid. This is your day.
Well, there are so many details in Exodus that I would have never known if I wouldn't have heard you speak about it, because all I've known about Exodus is what you see in the movies.
Yes.
And what really stands out is when they left Egypt in rank. They weren't running for their lives. They weren't scared. They were powerful in the Lord, and that's something I would have never known.
Yeah, left with a high hand. They didn't leave cowering, running away, terrified, scared to death. Who was scared? The Egyptians were terrified. The Egyptians were frightened. The leaders were terrified. The Pharaoh was scared. They were the ones that, quote, cowered down. And unlike what we may see in sometimes the movie or pictures, I'm not having judgment against a guy who wrote the book. That's his viewpoint. He tried to get something across. But it's very fascinating to look at Exodus from a different point of view than we have had. Yes.
I enjoyed learning that they weren't just wandering aimlessly, but there was days set apart, camps set up on specific days. There was God's reasoning for every step that they took.
Every single time. And it says there in the book of Numbers, we won't be there yet, it says, and God appointed the places where they are to encamp. How do we know that?
Well, do you want me to answer that question?
No, make a statement first.
No, I was just going to say, what really has intrigued me is just how often the same thread throughout Scripture, like how Abraham got to Canaan, but immediately had to go to Israel, but left with great riches, and now the children of Israel have done the exact same thing, and how even Yeshua, his father Joseph, took him down to Egypt.
Took him out
and
of Egypt.
It's always going down to Egypt and then going back up to the promised land. And it's just that it's that same thread over and over and over again that, you know, all of a sudden you see it, and it's
And what's
exciting.
So beautiful about this picture, okay, Egypt is the quote, dark place we think about, but prophecy says, my beloved Egypt. We don't say, God loves Egypt. Yeah, he says, my beloved Egypt. Now, according to scriptures, in the first 3 years, there'll be no rain on Egypt. And Egypt will do what? Repent and return to the Creator of heaven and earth. God is going to teach them during those 3 years, not to beat them up, but to teach and educate them to become like and become joined with all the house of Israel, actually all mankind, become to God. Yes?
That's interesting. Egypt standing with Israel, too, in the blockades and stuff.
They're the closest ones. I was going to say the exact same thing. Egypt is the one that has some kind of a tie. To Israel and doesn't want to go the way of the Arab countries have
and,
gone.
Isaac was not to go down to Egypt, neither was Jacob, except he got old. Isaac was the only one that didn't go down to Egypt. Very fascinating. It's another story altogether than that one. Yes, she had another statement. This one.
Number of ways, the journey of Israel is so much, it's like a very tangible manifestation of mankind's journey before the Lord. We are constantly struggling with God, and we used to be in Egypt. We are slaves to sin, and we're redeemed by the Lamb. And God constantly constructs us not to go back to Egypt, not to go back to our sinful ways of life.
It's a way of life, not the people of Egypt. But God took them down to Egypt, blessed them abundantly, and then took all the blessings away from them. Wow. What kind of God is that? Awesome one, yeah. One you should be in awe of. Wow. I better listen to what he has to say that my generation, my next kid, my son and my grandson and my great-grandson can, you know, walk and be with God. You know, it's like a great blessing at one time, but you take it for granted. And that's why you take it for granted. What does God do? Takes it away. What else if anybody, open, anybody? No one didn't answer my question yet. How do you know that every one of the encampments was exact location where the Elohim said, this is where I'm going to camp them at, and they weren't wandering? We had this belief they were wandering nomads. What do we find in Scripture that says they were not wandering nomads? The cloud. When it moved, they moved. When it didn't move, they did not move. They were not tribesmen wandering all over and lost. They weren't lost. God knew exactly where they were at, and he kept control of them. He kept them in obedience, shall we say. Harsh obedience, maybe. Maybe you don't like the idea of heart for 40 years. He says, I had to do this because I got to work the next generation. This generation is not working. So he waited 40 years. Why? Why did he just kill off that generation and just start right from there? Because the next generation had to learn. They had to learn from their mom and their dad. They had to learn from their previous generation. And basically not, you know, when you see someone does something wrong and they are punished by it this way or that way, you begin to say, okay, I do some thinking here. I can't do that because if I do that, he's going to kill me like he killed my dad, you know, whatever the situation is. And so they learn and say, respond and listen. They learned to hearken unto the word of God. And when they went into the promised land with Joshua, because there were some, of course, that complained. There wasn't a perfect generation, but majority of them went into that promised land. And they were led by the Levites, led by the ark that was walked across that water of Jordan River first, which Daniel had talked about. So what if, when we think back on the book of Exodus, it's really not about Exodus, is it? It's about a journey. I explained this to you before, and I'll explain it again. When they ever had an encampment, the next phrase is, they journeyed from. God was taking them someplace. And when we, in our personal private life, sometimes we don't think God is really taking us on a journey. I have to say, it's probably not a single person in this room. I dare say this. Maybe you might not. Has not been taken from this point to that point. And then, once you got that, he takes you from that point to the next point. Or this life to this life. This point was to one truth, to this 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 understanding, to this understanding, so on and so forth. That's what we do. God is now teaching us, by and through his Spirit, guiding and directing us to understand what he is thinking, how he thinks. And, as I said before, majority of you probably don't have a thing and said, I wonder what God wants me to do. Just take a look at your own private life and see what he's doing. Then you know, this is what he's doing. And as long as we say to ourselves, I will, if he journeys me from here to there, I am going to go. But he also said something very interesting. I will not lead you by the hand from now on. Remember that? Now is up to you. Where is your heart? Where is your desire? And of course, Deuteronomy says, we're not there. Oh, if there were heart in them. That's what God wants. If there were a heart in them, there wasn't one in them because God had not given them that heart. But you have grown and you've come past this point, not because you're wiser or smarter, because the Creator in His plan, in His time, has said, I am going to do something different now. I am going to write my laws in their hearts. When God writes His statutes and His judgments in your heart, puts it in the mind here, you got it, straighten it out, stop your thinking wrong, you do the right thinking, then it penetrates, writes into the heart, then you start literally walking in righteousness. You start living a holy life. You start living the way that God wants it, because in your heart, when the Spirit of God enters in and starts writing it very carefully and very precisely, as He's precisely told Moses, make sure you make this tabernacle exactly how I have shown you from above. And don't move the furniture where you want to move it. Leave, put it there and leave it there. Don't move it to where it might look prettier on the other side of town. Or rearrange your house so you have a new, I'm tired of my couch being over there, I'll put it over there. You don't do that with God's house, right? You don't do that with the tabernacle. So we learn something from that. In our growth now, within the Messiah, within God, within Christ, we are now learning to try to do one thing. What is it that you want us to do? And He tells you what. Right? Understand my statutes, understand my judgments, and do this. Establish them. There was an interesting statement in the book of Torah, from Genesis all the way to Deuteronomy. Does God give you a choice? Does God say, okay, you can obey this one if you want to. It's your free choice. And if you obey it, good. If you don't, that's okay. I'll overlook it. No, He doesn't. He says, by the way, I'm giving you, the book of Deuteronomy, that's part, we know it. I'm giving you two choices, people. I'm telling you, you either choose death or choose life. By the way, I want you to choose life. However, if you choose that one, that's, you don't have a right to choose death. You don't have a right to choose life. It is God who says, I will give it to you or I'll take it away. You understand what I'm saying? There's no rights with God. You don't have a right to talk to God. You don't have a right to choose what is right and what is wrong. You don't have a right to decide which laws you should establish and which law you should not establish. You cannot add to, nor must you take away from. You don't have a choice to say, I don't want that law. Get rid of it. I don't want that judgment. I disagree with that judgment. I'll ignore it. You can't do that. Yes.
So you mean you're telling us that if we accept one thing, we have to accept it all?
Yes. 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 Now, God, be honest with yourself and be honest with himself. Is it really that easy? It is not that easy. It is difficult. Not only is it difficult because the people around about you, we all get to blame, right? If they would just do this, then I would be able to do that. You know, God does not give you that out. You are to either do this or you are not to do that. If you decide to say, well, I'm going to do the not, and because the people around me do a not, He says, oh, you've chosen death, haven't you? Wow, that's pretty heavy, don't you think? We have to look at God and understand what He has. He says, you know what I want. You know what my will is. You know what my desire is. You know what my thinking is. You know my heart. You know my innermost being. You know what I'd like. And what did Jesus say to Philip? Listen, Philip, if you know me, you know the Father. What's just like? Okay, got the picture, Philip. Yeah, I got the picture. Now since we don't have, He's not there. There's no Yeshua here walking around and healing people, yeah, and blessing people and the cursing people, cursing cities. You know, I remember he did curse cities. Remember that? We seem to forget that he really did curse cities. What happened to the cities they cursed? They got cursed. The tree got cursed.
And, you know, so we know he has that ability to do that and that power to do that. But at the very same time, we also know something, that he will has a lot of patience, a lot of, quote, understanding. He doesn't give you an excuse to say, well, I'm just flesh and blood. I can't seem to overcome my anger. I can't seem to stop resenting this person. I can't seem to, oh, my wife is a pain in the, well, you know, I'm going to try to get my brain from that. You don't have an out. I don't have an out. We only have, quote, one way to go. If you have a hard time with somebody, get on your knees. And you don't pray for them, that they be nice to you, that you can be pleasant to them. No, you put in your knees that you become pleasant. You become one of God. You become one who says unto the Creator of heaven and earth, guide me, show me, teach me. What are we learning from the book of Exodus? We're learning that God says he put into action everything that took place in Exodus. What part of Exodus was he not involved in? What part of Genesis was he not involved into? What part do you not understand? What part is it is fable to you, and what part is true to you? You see, each one of us have to look at it and say, okay, I'm not quite sure. Well, how don't you find out? Get on your knees and ask God. You got a puzzle with the area in the Bible? Get on your knees, ask God, and wait for the answer. He's going to give it to you in ways you would never, ever anticipate. He may give it to you. I give it to you one of the most difficult trials that you'll have for 30 or 40 days. And it's miserable. And after it's all over with, you say, I got the picture. You know, thank you for teaching me. You know, Job said, I will bless you even though you'll kill me. That's a pretty powerful statement, isn't it? I will bless you even though you kill me. Now, there was an individual lived about, what, approximately 2,000 years ago, who God did kill. And what did he do? He blessed God. You don't think Jesus was killed by, you don't think God brought forth the death of the Messiah? You think God did not bring him down for him to be killed? God is in control of all things. He's very, very powerful. He can deliver anybody he wants. It's his choice. But he didn't send his son to live. He sent his son to die. Now I'll ask you a question. You know, King David said something. What is man that you're mindful of him? Well, I'm going to take that on a very, very personal base. If I was King David, I don't think King David was talking about mankind. King David was talking about himself. What? Why are you thinking about me for? Why do you... You are the greatest creator in the world, the face of earth has ever... You are it. Why are you bringing me into your mind? Why do you even think about me? I am nobody. I you know, and that's how I feel. And I didn't use David's name for myself personally. I used my own name. You know, and that's really, really striking. Who are you, O Creator of heaven and earth, to think about me, that my name is before you, that you sent and drawing me to where you are at? Who am I? Who am I to be able? Why are you wasting your time with me? Why don't you find people who are more loyal, more dedicated, more serious, more whatever it is? But why are you wasting your time with me? I don't dare tell him that, but you know, that's how I think. And the truth is, he has given us the answer. I created you for my pleasure, Richard. I didn't create you for your pleasure. I created you for my pleasure. And I'm bringing you home. I'm bringing you where I'm at. I'm bringing you to my world. And by the way, everybody you speak to, I know them by name. And I know who they are. And I am more mindful of them, or maybe I am as mindful of them as I am of you. That's a really big thing, isn't it? Put your name there. Why would God even think about calling you? Why would God even think about you? You who stumble, you who fall, you who fall short, you who don't seem to, quote, live up to the standards maybe that you have set or others have set, or maybe you realizing, I never live up to the standards that God has set. Why do you think of me, God? It's really hard for us as individuals to really look at this thing because there's other people. Now, Apostle Paul says something which is really, really strong. And I understand that completely. Think of others that are better than yourself. Think of others that God really wants more than He wants you. And it brings forth real, true humility. And you realize, wow, everybody in this room, in the eyes of the Creator of heaven and earth, deserves to be with God. Not because you're good, but because He has you in His mind, in His heart, in His being. He wants you to be alive. He wants you to live. And that's why you go through hard times, why you go through struggles, why I go through hard times, why I go through hard struggles, is that we learn to be humble, respectful, and honorable, not only to Him, but to each other. As I told you a couple of weeks ago, I don't find faults in people. I don't find faults in people. Because if I find faults in people, you know what makes me? Makes me think that I'm worthy of God's love. And they need to get where I am at to be worthy of God's love. It's not going to work, is it? And that's what I learned from the book of Exodus. I learned how God works. I learned how God thinks with a whole nation of people. In Genesis, with individual people. And if we go on through, and Daniel's going through the book of about David, how God deals with the individual king like David, and how it does the individual prophet like Samuel, like it does the individual people and the history of mankind, that God really has in His mind that He wishes and desires that none perish. I believe that with everything in my being. It doesn't mean that he will not perish, but he has so much compassion that he really truly sent his son and killed him. Wow. That puts really one-to-one. God is saying to me, you know I did this. And I said, yes, sir, I do. And you know that my son willingly said, if you slay me, I will still worship you. Yes, sir, I understand that. That's pretty heavy, isn't it? Now, when you think about the Egyptians, they were slain. Do you think they were slain because they are wicked people? Or do you think they were slain for what reason? Why were they slain? Because they were not worthy of the grace or the favor of the Creator of heaven and earth who created them? Was God not thinking about them? Or was He thinking about them? That's a tremendous sacrifice. That's why we have to be careful when we see somebody who's, quote, not walking according to how we would view him walking according to or her walking according to, end of quote, take a look and see what God is doing with that person. Try your very, very best to see the fruit of Creator of heaven and earth developing in them to be strong, courageous, and bold. By the way, every one of us, including myself, have been cowards before. And maybe every one of us, including myself today, are cowards. But it takes the power of God to make us strong. Because that's His object, to make us strong. I know it's more of a message today than going outline of Exodus, but I just wanted to bring this thing into you because we're going to the book of Leviticus next. And it's a very, sometimes a very laborious book. And maybe we have before God saying, I want to know what it's all about. Show me, teach me. And I just want to read it because I have to read it. I don't want to go to the Torah because I should be reading the Torah. Help me to understand what it's all about. Any questions? Any input of anything? Your what? Summary, yes, it is a summary. You remember we said, you know, in the very first part of Exodus is, they forgot a man. Who did they forget? They forgot about Joseph. Now it says Pharaoh forgot about Joseph. Wait a minute. Even the house of Israel forgot about Joseph. They weren't thinking of Joseph at all. What were they thinking about? Themselves. What else is new? When you are ever in a real difficult problem and you're sick or you don't have a job and you're losing your money and your house is going and you'd be out there, who do you think about, God? Myself. You pray, you cry out to God, you're not delivering me from this calamity. You know, who are you? You know, and it still goes away. Though he slay me, I will worship him. That's a pretty powerful statement. How many people are you aware of in the New Testament that were slain and they still worship God all the way to the end of their death? Even though God could have stopped it, delivered them from their horrible, wretched world that's coming against them. You remember the first one who was killed? James. Well, there's one before him. One before him. One before him.
John the Baptist.
John, there you go. So it's not uncommon for a guy to say, John, job's over with, off with your head. That was it. You know, that was it. Yeah, what did John do? Glad the guy says, no, I work for you, you owe me. No, off with your head. We said, well, no, it wasn't him, it was, you know, it was that king. Yeah, wait a minute. He could have kept himself from being killed. All he had to do is ignore the king, let the king do what he wants to do, and just go off in his corner and never tell the king the truth, knowing he could be killed. Yes.
Doesn't it say that the axe can't correct the arm that wields it?
The axe cannot correct it?
It doesn't...
Once it comes down, you can't stop it?
No, the axe itself does not correct or deal with the arm that wields it. God's the arm. We're the axe. If we choose to be an axe, then we bought our axe-ness.
Okay, I guess way of putting it. That's an interesting way of putting it. I hope that we went through Exodus quite lengthy, but I hope you learned an awful lot of new things and really realize it's only a one-year process, one short year in the life of Israel. And it wasn't like it lasted for eternity. It was one short year from Passover to Passover. Okay. And yes, another question or statement?
I appreciate when you talk about God's commandments, and He doesn't say that you have the right.
No.
And I came from the different culture from China, and and it's very sensitive towards the culture here. And I think here people talk a lot about it's everyone has a right for something. Everyone has a right.
Right.
And it's
right.
All about my right. My Yahoo, my way, my things. And how often we hear people say this is a fun thing to do because it's fun, I do it. Instead of this is the right thing to do. It's a meaningful thing to do.
Well,
so,
the difference between right thing and wrong thing, but not rights to do that which is wrong. Not rights to do that which is right. It's you either do right or you do wrong. Yeah.
Of course, you know, our founders talked about rights endowed by our Creator.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
Which, where do they come from?
Where do they come from, yes. Where did they come from? Now, does that mean, what does that mean? Okay. I'll put another word. Rights. Okay. What are, quote, the rights of God? What does he say? You have a, quote, right to either obey me or not to obey me, quote, end of quote. If I can use that phrase. You can have a right to be happy or unhappy. I'm setting the rules of what is right, just, and holy. Don't have anything against the writing of the Constitution. Don't be off that tangent. But what I'm saying to this is that we got to stop and think for a while. We are what? What was Abraham? We can be friends too. Next. A what?
Child of God.
Child of God. We are too. Next. We as an individual.
Was.
Okay, let's put it this way. I'm sorry, what? That's his action. That was his action. His action. Where did he live? Go up. Go up. He was a sojourner on this earth. You are a sojourner on this earth. I am a sojourner on this earth. That means something different now, doesn't it? Because you're answering to, quote, a different set of rules than our Constitution. I'm being up front, being honest with you. You are to answer to a different set of what is right and what is wrong. And you don't get to debate with the judge of the world. You don't get to debate with the legislator of the world who writes the laws. You don't get to debate against the administrator of those rules because God is all three. Is he not? All right. And so when you look at your world, we're living in every country has their own set of rules of this world. And this is the reason why we can get into a political arena. We get into political involvements. We're getting involved with, I'm very sorry about this if you disagree with me. That's okay. You can disagree with me. But when you get involved with politics, you're getting involved with the things of this world. Not what's above. Your mind should be above, your thoughts should be above, and you should be a sojourner on this earth. Obeying a different king. Obeying a different set of rules. For her first.
John and I were just thinking that another word for sojourner is pilgrim.
Pilgrim.
And the pilgrims were the ones coming to this new land to have religious freedom.
Right.
And they had more God's truth in establishing.
That was their object, yeah.
Yeah. Because we've just been watching that series of John Adams and the Liberty and stuff. Yeah. And when you understand, it was a good refresher. You understand that they were trying to have the freedom to do what God says. Okay. And there's some disagreements. I understand some different issues. And some would even call them theists today. But knowing their backgrounds, that's not really a fair statement. But the king was being oppressive and not allowing them the freedom to walk the way. And so many of our laws are based you know, maybe it could have been more closely based, but it was the Judeo-Christian ethics, so-called.
Right.
It was based on
but
that.
You
was falling away from
you
that.
You can't institute them on the general public.
Yeah, but I mean,
you can only institute them within yourself.
But the Constitution and the Declaration were freeing us from the bondage that would not allow us to exercise.
That's correct. I don't have a problem with the Constitution. Don't give me a
problem. Yeah, I understand.
I'm glad we have it. We are living, we're sojourning in this country. But, you know, so I don't have a problem. And if a person says, oh, my pursuit of happiness is to rape 3 women a day. Oh, I'm happy. Well, wait. Is that the pursuit of happiness? That's not what the founder said. But a person could take that. Oh, my happiness is to have a marijuana and drugs and alcohol and I'd be free to do it. Well, okay. Damage somebody else? Damage your mom, your dad? Damage to people around about you? Okay, yeah, you have that freedom to do that. However, since we are on a sojourner on earth, we're answering to something else, and he says, you're going to do what, Bill? You know what I want. Yes, sir. And you say, yes, sir. And you go that way. You don't do your own happiness. You don't do your own will. You don't do your own searching for, what was fulfillment? Repeat your statement for happiness and what was it?
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Liberty.
You don't even get to choose your own life. Who chooses your life for you? Yeah, he's the one that makes the decision. And he's already says, this is by this choice. My choice is for you to have life. However, it's my decision whether you have it or don't have it. We don't have the decision of life. Only God does. Jeff.
Yeah, which I think is an important point. It's not just whatever you think life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is. It's what the Creator said it is.
Yes. Okay. So I try to stay away from politics, and I brought that in. I'm sorry. But nonetheless, you know, you understand my point of view. And you go ahead and disagree with it. That's okay. And, you know, but this is my outward... So I do shout, don't I? I do yell, don't I? I told her, watch out today. I'm going to yell and shout.
Yeah, we were a sojourner on the earth, but we are on the earth. And Adam and Eve, God just commanded them to be, there are certain commandments and to manage the earth. And we have a dual citizenship on the earth too. And when we talk about totally detached from politics, I was thinking that throughout the Old Testament, and we see the consequences of the kings of Israel did to Israel, God says he will punish Israel because Manasseh is evil, because
right.
Which king? And I think as a citizen on the earth, we should be responsible for duties on the earth too.
Who we
elect.
I don't have the reason why we're on this earth to learn those things. We are responsible for our conduct on the earth. If we do not fulfill that conduct while we're on the earth, we will not be able to fulfill it in eternity. Don't get me wrong. But human beings have this grandizement. I'm going to be the greatest preacher. I'm going to be the greatest president. I'm going to be the greatest scientist. I'm going to be the greatest lawyer. I'm going to be the greatest judge. I'm going to be the greatest... Whatever. Also, that's arrogance. Humbleness. That's what God's looking at. You have a good... Jeff?
Well, it just was... Thing when people talk about the involvement of a believer in the kingdoms of the world and that kind of thing.
Right.
One thing to keep in mind is that, you know, for example, in Babylon, in Medo-Persia, you know, that was a dictatorship, an empire. Yet God placed a prime minister in there to pretty much manage things and keep things under control. Under Rome, Rome was another dictatorship.
Right.
So. Not really much you can do about that. However, we operate inside of a thing where, you know, the people supposedly are involved in doing something. So in this environment, different than Rome. Rome, you can't do anything about it. People in Palestine, you have no say whatsoever and even less say than anyone else. But here, we do have a say. So if we don't say, then it's our fault.
Right. I don't disagree. I mean, if there is a righteous person running... Or even he doesn't have the full righteousness of God, if they understand God, believe in God, and trust God, I don't have any problem for you guys to mark them on the ballot. I don't have a problem. I may be on a party that doesn't exist or a party that's so weak they'll never get there, but, you know, find some. I don't pick the worst of two evils. If there are seven people on there that are just anti-God, I don't cross, I don't mark any of them. All right? I'll leave it blank.
You still vote?
Yes. Well, I go in there and find out that sometimes, I'll be honest with you, really honest with you, lots of times I go out, nothing marked on the ballot. Just put it in there. They got a blank ballot because I can't. Internally, I can't. That's my personal approach thing. I don't try to find out who will do the worst amount of damage and vote for that one. I don't agree with that statement either. It doesn't make sense to me. All right? I'll be very honest with you. If we had two people running for governor of the state of California, both of them believe people should be killed at birth before they're born, guess what? I have a real difficult time saying, okay, I like that one better. And I will kill it in the first trimester, and then we'll do it on the seventh one or 20th one or whatever it is. They're still killing. You understand what I'm saying? You understand what I'm saying? I have a really hard time with that. Now, you may not have that problem. It may not be a difficulty for you. But you ask my political thoughts. Sheesh. Okay. Let's get off the Constitution.
Well, you know, actually, it's not a completely disparaging or even wandering thought to consider, because what is Exodus? It's a foundation where God talks about his commandments and statutes and judgments. So, you know, rather than being completely irrelevant to daily life, they're extremely relevant. And even the founders of this country thought they were. So.
Well, I don't have a problem with that. I mean, well, the heart is what you have to look at. But the underhandedness, I'll tell you, it's really difficult. And that, by the way, God will open up your eyes to the underhandedness of anybody running for president, if or Congress or Senate or governor, if you request this of him. Let him show you. Do not depend upon your wisdom. Do not depend upon your own understanding. Do not depend upon how you view things. Do your very best. If you don't know, get on your knees and ask God. You've got this sample ballot, right? Okay, here's all the governors. People are, which one, oh God? If there's no answer, I guess that's, the answer is no. I'm just my suggestion, you know. But there's nothing inside of you that says yes. This one, no, that one, no. You eliminate the no's first, real quick. No, 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 no. Yeah, that one you probably can figure out. Yes, Jeff.
Especially judges, Sharon points out. Especially ask for witnesses, because they're really hard to figure out where they stand.
Really hard.
So
information.